You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
It's long and thick, like a ropey red snake. It's rarely been seen and is spoken of in legends. It's feared by many, and some even say it shoots lightning. Oh, get your mind out of the gutter. We're talking about the Mongolian death worm.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. Today, we're going to talk with one of the most experienced cryptozoologists working today about some of the expeditions he's been on in search of mystery animals around the world, including the Mongolian death worm. But first, I'd like to remind you about a little expedition of my own. We've retooled our plans for the first ever Monster Talk cruise to make it more affordable. Prices are now starting at $500, and we'll be traveling from October 6th to October 10th, 2014. You'll have the opportunity to join me and the most popular guest we've had on Monster Talk, Dr. Ken Fader, as we sail to fascinating places, enjoy fun and games, and talk about monsters, and even have a chance to see Atlantis. I hope you can join me on this amazing journey. Go to cruise.monstertalk.org. That's cruise.monstertalk.org or call 1-800-794-7447 to book today. The Mongolian death worm is one of those monsters I've wanted to talk about but have been challenged because there's so little written about them. But our guest has spent more time looking for them than anyone I know. In this episode, Karen Stolzno joins me to interview Richard Freeman about this fascinating legendary animal and his experiences searching for cryptids.
Monster Talk.
So Richard Freeman is the zoological director for the Center for Fortean Zoology, which is the CFZ, if you're in the UK. He has gone around
Australia.
The world. Or Australia, or any place where they don't know how to say Z.
Oh.
He's gone around the world looking for mysterious creatures, including hairy hominids, giant snakes, supposedly extinct species such as the thylacine, and one of the oddest and most famous cryptids, the Mongolian death worm. Richard's also a frequent lecturer and television guest and the author of several books. So welcome to Monster Talk.
Pleasure to be here.
So how did you get interested in cryptozoology?
I can answer that in two words for you. Doctor Who. When I was a boy growing up in the 1970s, I was a fanatical fan of Doctor Who. It's the longest running science fiction serial in the world. And during the early 70s, the Doctor was played by a great actor called John Pertwee. He was always my favourite Doctor. And during his tenure, he was incarcerated on Earth by the Time Lords. So the creatures he met were always in your backyard. They were not on some far-off alien planet. So they were all the more compelling and frightening because they were in a familiar setting. So you had giant maggots crawling out of slag heaps in Wales. You had super evolved intelligent marine dinosaurs coming up out of the sea. You had alien intelligences that could animate plastic and turn anything plastic into a killer. And all these things were in modern day Britain. It made them all the more frightening. It got me completely hooked on monsters. And I was always interested in animals as well. And when I left school, I was a zookeeper for a number of years. I became head of reptiles at a major UK zoo. But the thing that really got me interested in monsters in the first place was Doctor Who. And, of course, the Doctor also fought the Yeti. He met the Yeti and the Loch Ness Monster. And this got me interested in allegedly real monsters at a very young age. And I, after my tenure at the zoo, I was out looking for the Beast of Bodmin Moor, which is one of the British big cats. And I happened across a little museum called the Potter's Museum of Curiosities at Jamaica Marin, in Bodmin Moor in Cornwall in England. Sadly, the museum isn't there anymore, but it was a fantastic tableau of stuffed animals and strange collections of odd heterogeneous objects. Like you would have the head of a man-eating crocodile preserved next to a model of a church made entirely out of feathers next to a Maori axe, and then two squirrels having a duel with swords, or some guinea pigs playing cricket, all stuffed, of course. And I came across this little magazine that was on sale there called Animals and Men, which wasn't nearly as rude as it sounded. And it was a magazine about cryptozoology. And it was a very, very good magazine. I was living in Yorkshire at the time, in the northeast of England. I was studying at Leeds University, and I got writing for them. I became the Yorkshire representative, and eventually I ended up coming down to be the zoological director of the Centre for 14 Zoology, which is the only full-time cryptozoological organisation in the world. And since then, I've been all over the world looking for strange creatures, and I've never looked back.
But that was more than two words.
But, you know, speaking of Doctor Who, I do actually have the novelization of Doctor Who and the Yeti.
Yes, the Abominable Snowman.
Right. One of my listeners gave me that as a sort of surprise gift. It was very nice.
And the sequel, which is called The Web of Fear, where the Yeti appear on the London Underground and the Great Intelligence manifests itself as an enormous ectoplasmic web that grows through the London Underground. That has been lost since the 1960s, and it's just turned up. They found it in Nigeria. And it's just been released over here on DVD.
Oh, really? I'd heard about them finding the lost episodes, but I didn't know it actually came out yet. So,
yeah.
So, Richard, how is cryptozoology different from regular zoology?
It shouldn't be, really. It's a branch of zoology like any other. And one of the things that I want to do is rescue cryptozoology from the lunatic fringe. We're not a bunch of madmen that believe in every insane story that comes along.
Speak for yourself.
the cryptozoology has largely been ruined by creationists and credulous idiots and people who are just too willing to believe in anything bizarre without sufficient proof. I'm not on a holy crusade to make people believe in monsters. I'm doing this because I'm interested in it mainly through my own interest. My contention is that there are large unknown animals still around. There are still creatures unknown to science, some of which may have been involved with legends in the past. But cryptozoology is so hogged by things like the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot and the stuff that is perhaps less likely to exist.
You know, it's been a recurring theme here on this show is just trying to kind of cover the spectrum. And we've had on some people who speak very well of cryptozoology, and we've also covered some of the nonsense that goes on. And I don't think there's any way to keep it pure. I mean, I don't think there's a way to keep out people who are interested in monsters. I think the best we can hope for, at least what I'd like to see out of this show, at least, is that you can teach people how to think critically and sort of filter out what is completely absurd and what's plausible.
I mean, I've just said the things less likely to exist. The Loch Ness Monster, I think, is explicable through known phenomena. I've seen alleged film of the Loch Ness Monster, which is undoubtedly a grey seal. Most of the photographs are fakes. Because of the nature of the loch, because of the shape of it, boat wakes can hit the side of the loch and then bounce back and be crossing the loch half an hour after the boat's passed. And they look like a row of humps. There may be some very big fish in Loch Ness. I investigated a a case in Lancashire in the northwest of England, where there's a very small lake, only about 5 feet deep and about 2 acres, called Martin Mere, where there were reports of a creature the size of a car pulling down full-grown swans and devouring them. And I thought this sounds highly unlikely. And we contacted the head warden there because it was a part of the Wildfowl Trust, and swans from Siberia and Iceland overwinter there. And they were being attacked by something. And this guy said, yes, there is something, and I've seen it. So he went up to investigate. And he said he saw something about the size of a settee swimming around in this, what is tantamount to a muddy puddle. And I was standing by the banks of this lake, Martin Mere, thinking there is no way a large predator can live in this lake. And then suddenly it came to the surface, 8 feet away from where I was. And it was a huge Wells catfish, an immense catfish.
Wow.
To think a fish of that size could live in a lake so small was mind-boggling. Now, if you're walking along the shores of Loch Ness, you have to remember, Loch Ness is the most famous lake in the world. And it's famous for having a monster. Even if you don't believe in a monster, a monster's there at the back of your mind. So if you see something odd out on the lake, another lake, you might think, oh, what's that out there? Is it mating ducks? Is it fish jumping? There, it's the monster. Whatever happens, it's the monster.
Yeah.
So if you saw a big catfish or a huge eel in Loch Ness, it would be the monster.
I think that the cultural priming that you're talking about there is becoming a bigger problem. The more popular things like Bigfoot become, then the more likely people are to misidentify bears and that sort of thing.
But I have to say, I'm fairly convinced that there's something to the Asian Yeti. I'm 100% convinced there's something to the Orang Pendek, but I'll talk about that later. But with Bigfoot, I've always found it much, much harder to swallow. But there are things about Bigfoot that give me pause for thought. And one of them is the Patterson footage. Because I used to be a zookeeper, and I work mainly with reptiles, but the zoo I was at, it's called Twycross Zoo in the Midlands in England, was famous for its collection of monkeys and apes. And I've worked with all the known apes very closely. And the thing in that footage has the presence of an ape. Now, I've seen plenty of people in monkey suits floundering around pretending to be Bigfoot. That is the only sequence of footage where I get the feeling that what you're looking at is an ape and not a person.
And you mentioned the Orang Pendek. What do you think are the most likely real cryptids?
The two that jump out immediately that I am as near as damn it to 100% sure are still out there are the Orang Pendek and the Tasmanian wolf.
We've actually had on people to talk about possibly resurrecting the Tasmanian wolf. So if it's not around, I hope we get to bring it back just for the cool factor, if nothing else.
Yeah. But we know this creature existed until the 1930s. And since 1936, there have been 4,000 sightings of this animal. And some of these have been made by zoologists and park rangers. Now, I was over in Tasmania in November. I had no idea that Tasmania, which is about the size of Ireland, has a population of less than 500,000. Most of those are in Launceston and Hobart. Once you get out of those places, the towns are very small. They're more like villages. The villages are virtually non-existent. And there is masses and masses of wilderness. In the north and the northeast of the island, there are huge forests that stretch on and on and on and on. And down in the southwest of the island, it's virtually uninhabited. There's no roads in and out there. There's one mine. There's a port with a few fishermen and some copper miners. And they go in and out by boat or helicopter. And the rest of the southwest peninsula of Tasmania is utterly uninhabited.
Now, you actually just did an expedition there, right? So first of all, how does one go about going on an expedition for something like this? And can you tell us a little bit about your experiences on that?
Yeah, well, I wrote an article on setting up a cryptozoological expeditions once. And the key to it is getting good guides. Well, in Australia, they speak the same language. But in other parts of the world, the thing is to get a decent native guides who know what they're doing, who can find witnesses, who can set things up so you hit the ground running. That's the big key. Now, I've got friends in Australia. Mike Williams, Tony Healy, and Rebecca Lang, who did a lot of the groundwork for this. It was their initial idea, and they invited me along very kindly. And Tony Healy is probably Australia's longest-serving and most experienced cryptozoologist, and he was down there for a couple of weeks before I got down there. Now, we were only there for 2 weeks because it's all down to the folding green stuff. If I had the money, I would be spending months and months and months in these areas. And to give you an example, the snow leopard, which is an animal we're all very, very familiar with, when zoologists first went out to try and capture the snow leopard on film in the early 70s, it took them something like 6 or 7 years before they found one of these things and filmed it. So you really need to spend a hell of a lot of time doing these things. And we managed to speak to a number of witnesses, and we decided early on that we were going to keep the exact location we were looking at secret and keep the people's names secret, not so much because of them, but because they asked us not to reveal where it was because they're worried about the animal. We talked to a man who is a government licensed shooter, and he goes out to keep the numbers of wallabies down. And he goes right out into the bush, and he's a real bushman. And he had absolutely no axe to grind about this. And he told us that he'd seen the thylacine twice crossing the road in front of his vehicle. And he was very worried about it getting out exactly where these sightings were. So he made us promise not to tell anybody exactly where. We've got all the notes. We know where they were. It was good enough, but like most of the people we talked to, they were very worried about the creature. Another man, often they're from cars. People see them at night when they're driving along. Another man saw one of these things run out in the road in front of him, and the car behind them stopped as well. So it was a multiple witness sighting. Again and again, we got these stories, and there was nothing sensational about them at all. And I was convinced, pretty convinced this thing was still around before I went, and I'm 100% convinced now.
On average, how much does an expedition like this cost? Can you put a price on something like this?
Well, they vary wildly depending on where you're going. I mean, the last time I was in Sumatra with the guides and getting over there and the food and the equipment, it cost about £5,000. Mongolia was slightly more. Mongolia was about £6,000. The cheapest we ever did was the Gambia in West Africa, and that only cost about £300. But that was not a typical expedition. We stopped in a hotel then, and that does not, in my book, constitute an expedition when you've when you've fallen off cliffs and the Russian mountains and being in sandstorms in Mongolia. Staying in a hotel in Gambia does not count as an expedition.
But where does the money come from?
We pay it ourselves. We finance it ourselves. Very rarely we get financed by television companies. When we went to look for the giant anaconda, we actually got financed by a games company, Capcom. They had a new game out called Monster Hunter, and they wanted to do a tie-in with us, but they wanted us to go to Guyana in South America. We'd got a contact in Guyana, but they wanted us to go in October, which was their dry season, which is not ideal to go, but it was to tie it in with the release of this game. And unfortunately, they were having the worst drought in living memory. So the rivers were so low, you couldn't get out to these remote lakes where these colossal anacondas were supposed to have been seen. And it was the toughest expedition I've ever done. I can handle the heat. It's cold that I can't stand. But we were on the grasslands of South America, not in the jungle. During a drought, even the natives couldn't stand it. It was so hot. And it felt like your brain was being boiled inside of your head. And I could walk for about 100 yards and then I'd just collapse with heat stroke. It's unbelievable. So I'd like to go back to South America, but during the rainy season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about a lot of monsters on Monster Talk. We're just a lot of different folklore monsters and myth monsters. But we haven't talked about the Mongolian death worm, and it's one that I've wanted to talk about for a while.
It's one of our favorites, really.
Yeah, but it is. Yet at the same time, there's just not a lot of material on it. But I was hoping that you could help us learn a little bit more about this creature.
Yes, I was over in Mongolia in 2005. And of all of the places I've been, Mongolia is the weirdest and the most alien. The Gobi Desert is something utterly fantastical. You think of deserts as being sand, and part of it is sand, but other parts look like cat litter trays that stretch off into infinity. And other parts look like huge mirrors because it's all mica, reflective mica. Other parts look like the surface of Mars, all red and twisted. It was utterly amazing. There's a place called the Flaming Cliffs because the cliffs look like fire. The death worm itself, when you hear stories of it over here, it's a case of Mongolian whispers, because by the time it gets to the West, it's a monster worthy of Doctor Who. It's supposed to be blood red, 5 feet long, it spits acid, it unleashes blasts of electricity like an electric eel. When you actually get over there and talk to the witnesses, you hear something completely different. We travel for about 1,000 miles through the Gobi, interviewing nomads, and they say it's about 2 feet long, about as thick as your arm. They call it Alroy Huihui, which means intestine worm, because they say it looks like a length of cow's intestine. I say it's shaped like a salami. It's hard to tell which end is the tail, which end is the head. It's scaly, reddy brown in color. It doesn't generate blasts of electricity. They say throwing lightning. They say that's just folklore. It doesn't happen. They believe that it's poisonous and it can spit, and they have a deep dread of it. So one man we talked to had seen the death worm when he was tending his family's livestock as a boy. And he told his parents, and they packed up their gur, which is the circular tents they live in, packed up their gur and their livestock and moved out of the area. And we interviewed about 24 witnesses, and they ranged from a man in his 80s that had seen the death worm way back in the 1930s, to a man in his 40s that had seen it just the year before. And we were getting the same description again and again and again of this salami-shaped creature. Most people just saw it lying in the desert and thought, right, I'm leaving that alone. One old ex-colonel on an old military base we met, he saw one whilst he was on patrol once, early one morning, went back to get his camera, but when he got back, as they always do, it had gone. But one man said he'd seen it grab and eat a mouse. And one woman said she'd seen it slithering out of a hole in a Saxel forest, in the roots of a Saxel tree. Another man said that one of the ones he had seen had been killed by some Russian scientists who were collecting snakes. It was killed and taken away as a museum specimen. So there may well be, in some Russian museum, a preserved Mongolian death worm. And no one knows what it is. It's probably locked away in a basement somewhere, because 90% of natural history museum specimens are off show. You may remember Delcourt's giant gecko. It was the world's biggest gecko. It's about a meter long, about 3 feet long, which is huge for a gecko. Completely unknown to science. And a stuffed specimen of one of these was on display in a museum in Paris for years and years and years, until a gecko expert happened by, just by chance, saw it, and his jaw hit the floor. And we still don't know if this creature it's supposed to come from New Zealand. We still don't know if it's alive or extinct. We only have one specimen. But I'm sure there are many cryptid specimens in museums around the world. Debbie Marta, who's the head of the Indonesian Tiger Conservation Group, who's seen the Orang Pendek on 4 separate occasions, she says she's sure that there's Orang Pendek material in Dutch museums, because Sumatra was once a Dutch colony, that's been mislabeled orangutan. But the death worm, we came to the conclusion that it's not a worm at all, it's some sort of burrowing reptile. It may well be a worm lizard or amphisbaena. These are neither worms nor lizards nor snakes, but they're related to snakes and lizards. But they're strange, cryptic, burrowing reptiles that are sausage-shaped. And this sounds like a very large version of an amphisbaena, or possibly a sand boa, which are constricting snakes that live in arid climates, and they tend to be also very chunky sausage-shaped creatures. And there's a type of sand boa in East Africa, and in Somalia they call it the apris, and they are terrified of it. They believe it's so poisonous that it doesn't even have to bite you to kill you. If you just touch it, if you so much as touch it, you'll die. Like they thought of the salamander in medieval Europe. In fact, it's completely harmless. It's a small constrictor. It feeds on mice. It doesn't even have venom. I think something similar has happened with the death worm. I'm convinced it's probably an amphisbaena, and this mythalization process has happened. It gets attributes grafted onto it that it doesn't actually have, but it doesn't mean that the animal doesn't exist. At one time, it was thought, natives would tell you in Africa that gorillas would tear branches from trees and beat elephants to death with them, or they'd come into villages and carry off native women and rape them. In fact, a gorilla's erect penis is about the size of my little finger. They're remarkably poorly endowed, and they're very placid animals unless provoked, but they've had these myths grafted onto them. But it doesn't mean that there's no such thing as gorillas, and I think it doesn't mean there's no such thing as the death worm. I think it's a fairly innocuous animal, and I said if I would have come across one, I'd have captured it barehanded to prove that it's a harmless creature.
Yeah. Well, how venomous the creature is supposed to be kind of sounds a bit like some of the creatures we have in Australia, like the box jellyfish or the blue-ringed octopus. They can be extremely dangerous and fatal by merely touching them or stepping on them.
The people who talked about the death worm, they said it spits venom, not acid, it spits venom. And if the venom touches things, it turns green and they die. But they never knew anyone who had been killed by it. Lots of people had seen it. No one had actually saw it spitting poison. No one had knew anybody that had been killed by it. They'd just heard friend of a friend stories of someone who knew someone who got killed by a death worm.
So are there any other stories of similar creatures in other deserts, like in Australia Yes. or in the United States?
Well, there's others in Asia. There's the shark orkoi, the yellow worm, which comes from, if memory serves me correctly, it's part of the former Soviet Union, Kazakhstan or somewhere. But it's supposed to be, whereas the death worm is supposed to be reddish in colour, this thing is supposed to be yellowish. And there are stories of a number of them being seen together, whereas death worms, they're usually just seen alone.
So how do you actually go about trying to track one of these down when you're on the ground?
You find out as much as you can about your target cryptid. With the death worm, we found out that it's supposed to emerge after rainfall, and it's usually seen around watercourses. So we hung out a lot of oases, and we went out into the deserts in the early morning after rainfall to look for the thing. We were going to try and dam a small stream in an oasis to make a localized flood to see if we could bring one to the surface through flooding its burrow. But the stream was very, very deep-sided, so it wasn't practical to do it. We did take out buckets as well, to make bucket traps, where you dig a hole in the ground, you put the bucket in, and then between the buckets, you put a row of these buckets, and between them, you erect a small fence. So if something's crawling along at night, bumps into the fence, moves along the fence, it will fall into the bucket, and you've got your specimen. But all we caught was insects. But once again, we weren't out there anything like long enough.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I'd seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley. Not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Did you have flashbacks to Dune?
Yeah,
everyone. A little tremors.
When you say Mongolian death worm, everyone imagines something huge, hundreds of feet long, with great jaws. This thing's it's about 2 feet long.
Do you think those kind of Western culture influences will affect the stories? Like it would feed back and change the things people would see, or is this entirely just a localized? I mean, how big of an area does the story of the death worm affect?
It's southern Mongolia, the Gobi, and it'd be interesting to see if there are similar stories in the north of China, because the Gobi, of course, goes into the north of China, and we've got quite near to the Chinese border. So I'm almost certain that the animal lives there too. I'd like to know what it's called over there and if they have the same sort of folklore about it. But it's a massive area, the size of Europe. And once again, in Mongolia, there's a population of about 1 million in this gigantic country. And you can drive for days and days and not only see no other human beings, but no sign of any other human beings, no buildings, no agriculture, nothing, just emptiness.
It's just like Kansas. So I've heard, too, that the creature hibernates for most of the year.
Well, the story was that it hibernates and it only comes out at the very hottest months, which is June and July. Well, once again, actually, when you talk to people, they've seen it from May through to September. So that's another piece of folklore.
Okay. Like a hurricane.
Do you take protection for, I mean, if you were like hunting spitting cobras, I assume you would at least have a face shield with you. Do you take anything like that?
No, because I don't think it'd be a cobra.
But if you're wrong.
if I'm wrong, I will be the first cryptozoologist to be killed by a cryptid. What a way to go. But I've handled poisonous snakes before. I used to be a zookeeper. I've handled poisonous snakes. I got attacked by a spitting cobra in Africa.
Oh. So what do you think is the best evidence for this creature so far?
For the death worm?
Yeah.
Well, there's no film of it. There's no photographs of it, but I'm not surprised, because when you go over there, the people don't have cameras, and one of the things they prize above anything else is if you've got an Instamatic camera, which is hard to get hold of these days, if you've got an Instamatic camera, if you can take a photograph of them and give it to them, they love that. That's one of the greatest gifts you can give, because they don't have things like that. But I think the best bet is to look in museums, look in the Russian and former Soviet museums for specimens of the death worm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those creatures, it's not gigantic. So if you're over there, you saw one, you could probably catch it and bring it back to Ulaanbaatar, the capital, and prove that it exists. If you were in the right time at the right place, you could catch it.
Have you guys considered Kickstarter?
Well, that's something that the guy that set up the Center for Fortean Zoology is a chap called John Downs. And he's looking into that at the minute. He's looking into things like Kickstarter. For expeditions, it's a new avenue we're going up at the minute. I mean, we fund it ourselves from. I write books. I do a bit of television. I lecture. I've lectured at the Natural History Museum, the Grant Museum of Zoology, and various venues up and down the country. But we do exist on a financial knife edge. Just recently, my latest expedition to Sumatra was financed by Scienté, which is a French company that makes science documentaries. And I was over there in June, July last year. We had a very successful expedition, found lots and lots of tracks and handprints. We heard the creature calling, and we talked to We amassed more witnesses than ever before and interviewed them all. And once again, they're all describing the same animal. I've been over to Sumatra now, 5 times. And my colleague, Dave Archer, and one of our guides, the late Sahar Dimas, in 2009, they actually saw the creature in a tree from only 100 feet away. And it got down from the tree and walked away like a man. Now, as I've said before, I've worked with all the known species of apes, and I've seen its handprints and its footprints, and the footprints are not like any other species of ape. The heel is much broader, much more human-like. It has a offset prehensile big toe, but it walks erect like a man. Now, some of the hair we got from that 2009 expedition was analysed by Lars Thomas, who is a biologist from the University of Copenhagen. And he says that the structure of it and the DNA, he says the DNA was fragmented because it had been in the forest a while, but it was similar to, but distinct from, Sumatran orangutan. Now, my theory about the orang pendek is that it's the third extant species of orangutan. There are 2 orangutan species in the world today. There's Pongo pygmaeus, the Bornean orangutan that is more robust, and the more gracile Sumatran orangutan, Pongo abele, which is only found in the extreme north of Sumatra, whereas orang pendek is seen in the west of Sumatra. And in historic times, there have never been Sumatran orangutans in the west of Sumatra. Now, until recently, it was thought the Bornean and the Sumatran orangutan were subspecies, but now we know that they're individual species and that they speciated, they broke off from each other, about 400,000 years ago on the Sundar landmass. Now, when the ocean levels were lower, Sumatra, Java, Borneo, and the Malayan Peninsula were all part of this one big landmass called Sundar. But the 2 orangutan populations had already split off before the ocean levels dropped and Sumatra and Borneo became islands. Now, my theory is that there was a third species of orangutan, one adapted for living on the forest floor rather than an arboreal existence, and that's what the orang pendek is.
I know we had Darren Nash on, and the orang pendek was one of the creatures he's really hopeful about, and I guess I am too.
Yeah,
one of the more likely sounding cryptids.
He says it's the only man-like creature he thinks exists. I think it's the most likely. I think the Yeti exists, and it's certainly not a goddamn bear.
But
The Indian Yeti earlier, and you went there and did an expedition as well. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, you've heard this thing with Professor Brian Sipe, so I know. He's a really nice guy and a first-rate scientist. He got this hair from an alleged Yeti, and the DNA from it turned out to be from a hybrid bear, and one of the parents of this bear was from a lineage of polar bears that were thought to have died out 40,000 years ago. Now, that's absolutely fascinating. It's brilliant, but it's not the Yeti. It's like me saying to you, I've got hair from a giraffe, so rhinos don't exist. They're 2 completely different things.
Well, he didn't say that it didn't exist.
He didn't say that personally. He didn't say that. But the inference of the program was. But the thing was, they already knew it was a bear of some kind when they got the hair. Now, if you actually talk to the witnesses, which they didn't, there was one local person they talked to, and he hadn't seen the Yeti. He'd had some livestock killed by an animal, which he thought was a bear.
Hmm.
If you talk to witnesses, they describe something which is transparently a primate. And the people I spoke to, they were adamant what they hadn't seen was a bear. They described it as looking like a colossal man or an upright gorilla. It was black. The Yeti isn't white. This whole sorry, ridiculous thing that the Yeti is white comes from a mistranslation of the Sino-Tibetan Mito Kangme, which means abominable man of the rocks. It was mistranslated as abominable man of the snows. And there are 2 things that really, really grind my gears. It's when the Yeti is portrayed as white and when in films, dragons are only given 2 legs. Dragons have 4 legs and 2 wings.
So why do you hate Rudolph?
Maybe it's an albino one.
Incidentally, Rudolph, like all the other of Father Christmas's reindeer, is female. They would all.
I've heard this before, but I don't remember why.
I haven't.
Yeah, well, reindeer are the only deers where both sexes have antlers. Males use them for fighting, females use them for scraping away the snow to get at lichen. By the time Christmas has rolled around, the rutting season's over and the males have dropped their antlers. But the females retain them for slightly longer. So if Father Christmas has got all these reindeers pulling his sleigh, they're all going to be female.
Didn't think of it that way.
I've lost my thread now. Hollywood has this thing about portraying dragons with only two legs. In folklore, dragons are supposed to have four legs and two wings. If they only have two legs and two wings, they're wyverns, which is something completely different. But they're so lazy in Hollywood. They did it with The Hobbit recently. And that's a book that I absolutely love. And I think Peter Jackson has shafted that book and completely ruined it. And once again, he portrayed Smaug as only having two legs, when every illustration Tolkien did was of an animal with four legs and two wings. But I digress. That's just something I had to get off my chest.
Well, no. I mean, no, monster nerds. I mean, that's the thing. You, I kind of guessed that the artists were trying to make it anatomically more plausible with real world biology, just because we don't really have any large reptiles or mammals that have two arms, two legs, and an extra set of limbs for wings, right? So, that's just a guess, but you're right. It's, your real dragons have the four and the wings.
Richard mentioned The Hobbit, and isn't there a reference in The Hobbit to, the Mongolian death worm? Some kind of wereworm?
Oh, yes. This is some obscure, when Tolkien was,
Oh, now some obscure Tolkien. That's going to.
It was an early draft of The Hobbit where he talks about some killer worms from the deserts of the East. And it's thought to be a reference to the death worm, which was mentioned by, Roy Chapman Andrews, the paleontologist, who was one of the first Westerners to go over to Mongolia. They based, Indiana Jones
on. That's right.
And he was looking for the origins of man. Instead, he found lots and lots of dinosaur eggs, which I think is much more interesting. But he was told by the Prime Minister of Mongolia to look out for the death worm and see if he could capture one. He thought it was nonsense. He didn't think there was such a creature, but he mentioned it in his book.
But you're fairly confident that if it exists, it's not a worm.
No, it's not an annelid worm. It's a reptile of some sort. But another one I think is likely. It's a giant anaconda in South America. When I say giant, I mean 45, 50, 60 feet. I don't mean 100, 150, 200 feet.
What's the upper limit for what we found?
The biggest anaconda was about 27 feet.
27.
Yeah. The reticulated python was 33 feet, but nowhere near.
And then Titanoboa was 45?
Titanoboa was 43 to 50 feet.
Yeah.
But the thing about the anaconda is it doesn't lay eggs. The female retains the eggs inside her and she gives birth to live young. Viviparous. They've severed their last link with the land so they can stay in the water getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. I talked to a guy called Mark O'Shea. You may have seen him on television documentaries. He's a snake expert and he goes around the world catching snakes. He's not unlike Steve Irwin, but he's got a big ginger beard. I was talking to him about it once, and he says, yeah, he thinks that the giant anaconda is real. We're not talking about a new species of monstrous snake. We're talking about freak individuals within a population that get very, very big. And if there's a big specimen, and it would be a female with snakes, with crocodiles, it's generally the males that are the big ones. With snakes, it's the females. So it would be a female. Male anacondas are only about a third of the size of the females. It will be a big female in a remote, undisturbed areas that are putting all their energy into growing. Got a good food supply. They put all that energy into growing.
Hmm. So kind of like a koi that grows as large as its environment.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, reptiles keep on growing throughout their lives. They just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. The growth rate slows down, but they carry on growing. So, an anaconda 60 foot long is not impossible. And a snake that big would be quite capable of killing a full-grown bull or a stallion. and swallowing it whole.
Frightening thought.
And they call them, in some parts of South America, they call them Manatoro, the bull killer. When we were in Guyana, our guide was a guy called Damon Corry. And he's a brilliant man. And he's the hereditary chief of the Eagle Clan Arawak tribe. They're a tribe of Amerindians, and he's their chief. And he's very well respected. And he runs this thing called First Nation Vacations, where he takes people off the beaten track. If you put Damon Corry into a search engine, you'll get him. He takes people off the beaten track in South America. He told us about some hunters from his tribe that had been in a place called Corona Falls in Guyana, and they'd seen an anaconda so vast that they ran away from it. And he was saying, how big was it? And they said, well, there was a fallen tree, and they pointed to a palm tree. And this palm tree was about 40 feet long. And they said, there's a tree like that, and it had fallen over, it was dead in the swamp. Mm-hmm. And the anaconda was crawling over it, and its head and its tail stretched beyond each side of the tree.
There's an idea. Have you ever thought of, to raise money for your expeditions, to take people along, or would they be getting in the way?
Well, that's another thing we're toying with at the minute. We've got to look into legislation and stuff, and
insurance
is the big thing. It's something we're just starting to look into now. I mean, I tried to get companies interested. There was a Tasmanian tiger beer, and there's Yeti cycles, and lacrosse that have the sports where they have the crocodile. I wrote to them with seeing if they'd like to sponsor a trip to the Philippines looking for a 30-foot man-eating crocodile in a Gusan marsh. And most of the big companies didn't give you the time of day. The smaller companies wrote back saying, this is great, we'd love to, but we just don't have the money.
Yeah. I think Kickstarter is going to be your way to go. Let me just say this. I'm a skeptic, and I love monsters, right? That's really my whole thing. And I firmly believe in looking for them and not just sitting on the couch and deciding whether they're real or not. In general, I mean, if they defy, I'm not going to go looking for dragons or support the hunt for dragons if we're looking for animals with four limbs plus wings. I just can't, you know, evolution doesn't seem to suggest that's out there. But to look for plausible biological animals, I bet you can get plenty of support through a Kickstarter type thing. And, you know, if you went ahead and filmed, you know, I don't know what kind of a camera person you are, but maybe you could then get some residual income off of the DVD.
Yeah.
Well, we do film most of our expeditions, and we've got them up online. We've got a thing called CSZ TV, and most of our expeditions are turned into full-length films, and they're up for everybody to see. But we've been toying with the idea of Kickstarter for some time, and I always thought that television would be more interested than they are.
Then you got to fit their narrative, though. You're going to fit the narrative of whatever the producer and director want to give you.
Every year we get approached by dozens of companies that want to do this, that, and the other. And generally, you never hear from them again. Worst case scenarios, you get your research stolen.
That's happened to you, has it?
Oh, yes, yeah. There's a company way back when I was a student, in Leeds, which is in Yorkshire, in the northeast of England. And I was trying to get an expedition to look for the Tasmanian wolf. And this company, it was for a series called To the Ends of the Earth. It was on British television. And they said, we hear you're trying to get this expedition together. We want to do a documentary. Would you like to come and lead this expedition and we'll film it? And I said, oh, is the Pope Catholic? So I came down to London from Yorkshire, which when you're a student costs a lot of money. I came down twice at my own expense and told them everything I knew about this animal in excruciating detail, what to do, what not to do, where to go, all my theories and ideas. And then they said, yes, we've just got to check with a few people in Australia and then we'll be back to you. Then I get this letter saying, oh, we've decided not to use you because the producer wanted to use a pretty girl instead. Another company more recently, it was actually when I was out looking for the Yeti in India, There was a company that wanted me to go on a panel of inverted commas experts to talk about Mystery 8 worldwide. It was for a, it was called The Ultimate Guide to Bigfoot, and it was a 2-hour documentary, but I was away when they filmed that particular segment. They wanted me to go, I think it was to Canada, to be on this panel. But they said, oh, instead, could you do some research for us? And they wanted me to plot every sighting of the Yeti, the Orang Pendek, the Almasti, the Yeren, so they could do like an animated map of where these sightings have been in the country and the dates and so forth. And I did this, and it took me 3 days to do all this. And they said, "Oh, we'll make sure you get credit for it, and we'll send you a copy of the film when it's done." They didn't send me a copy of the film. I had to track it down online because it was never shown on British television. I had to track it down online, and I didn't get a credit for it. And this has happened again and again and again.
Now, yeah, we've had experiences. We've had experiences like that too, with just producers calling, and they're too lazy to do their own research, and just spending hours with them, and then you never hear from them again. So
the last
definitely
one
happens.
Something. I think it's been. I can't remember if it was the Discovery Channel or National Geographic. I've got a feeling it was this Discovery. They were doing something about mysteries in Russia, and they wanted information on the Almasti, the Russian creature, which maybe, my theory about this is that it's possibly an early offshoot of the first wave of Homo erectus. But I was over there in 2008 in the Caucasus Mountains, on the trail of this creature, and we met people, including the deputy head of a national park who had seen one of these things. And the people over there are quite baffled when you come and ask them about it, because they say, well, why have you come all this way to just ask us about this? Because to them, it's another creature, like a wolf or a bear, no more fantastical. And there was one night we were staking out an old abandoned farmhouse. And two of the guys that went with me was a Ukrainian guy called Gregory Panchenko, who's a biologist, who's seen one of these creatures close up in an old barn. And there's another guy called Anatoly Serendenko, who's an archaeologist, who'd also seen one. And this old farmhouse we were at, there'd been sightings of the alleged sightings of the Almasti around there. And it consisted of three rooms and an L-shaped veranda running around the outside. And we'd set up some camera traps outside and then waited. And it got very cold, and it was about 2:30 in the morning. And we went into one of these rooms to warm ourselves around a little stove. And there was a large door, a big wooden door, about 7 feet tall. It was about 4 or 5 inches ajar. And it was a very clear night, and there was moonlight and starlight streaming in. And I was there with a chap called Adam Davis, who's a friend of mine, another cryptozoologist. And we heard this big, deep, guttural vocalization from outside. And it went something like, bum, 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 bum. But my lungs and my throat can't do it. It was, had much more bass to it. And I said, did you hear that? And he said, yes. And about 25 seconds later, this is 2:30 in the morning, something walked along the veranda. Whatever that something was, it was on two legs, because when it passed the door, it blocked out the starlight and the moonlight to a height of 7 foot. And I said to Adam, there's something out there on the veranda. We grabbed our digital cameras, went running out, and we just found silence and darkness. Whatever it was, it had vanished into the night. And I can't say that that was an Almasti. It was something big on two legs that walked along the veranda. It wasn't a bear, because bears don't walk around on two legs as a threat posture when a bear stands up. And a bear would have made more noise. So what it was, I don't know. But it was a very, very interesting night, to say the least. Now, I told them all this, and they got rid of the research got really excited. So, oh yeah, we want you to come down to London, we'll pay your expenses, we'll give you a fee of £200, and you know, I was going to take a day out of my schedule to do all this. And then they got back to us and said, oh no, they've decided they want someone with an American accent. it doesn't matter that you've been there and looked for it, and you may have got possibly have got close to one. They just wanted somebody with an American accent. Yeah. That's how fickle television is.
Yeah, very superficial.
If you've got a pretty face, yeah. Oh, yeah, you've got a pretty face. It doesn't matter. You've done all this research on the thylacine. No, we just want someone with a pretty face.
Yeah, I've got a face for radio. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, but I have to say, the French company, Scienti, were brilliant. They did everything they said they were going to do. It was just myself, the cameraman, this French cameraman called Chris Killian, and an exceptionally beautiful taxidermist from London called Adele Morse. And then we had the native guides. So it was just a little group of us. We went out there and we had a fantastic expedition. We got loads of results. We heard the creature vocalizing. We found masses, more tracks than we've ever found before. Interviewed more witnesses, and it was brilliant. And now there's talk of doing a series with the same guy and, you know, expanding this out into maybe 20 episodes looking for different cryptids around the world. So I'm waiting with bated breath on that. It would be lovely to have a series about cryptozoology that is science-based.
Yes.
And it's got people running around in the woods shouting, screaming, saying, there's a Squatch in these woods, when they hear something rustle.
Yeah, well, I wish you success, but I'm afraid I think if you want to get that kind of level of integrity, you're going to have to do it yourself. But that's just my suspicion. I guess we've run out of our hour here. We try to ask everybody who comes on Monster Talk this question, which I probably should have prepared you for, but what's your favorite monster?
My favorite monster from ancient legend is the dragon. It's the king of the monsters. Forget about demons, vampires, werewolves.
You mean Godzilla? Godzilla's king of the monsters.
Yeah, well, he's sort of a demon, isn't he? They're found in every culture on Earth going back 25,000 years. Could be that there's something like Megalania or one of its relatives that is still possibly around in maybe New Guinea or somewhere like that. Maybe not Megalania per se, but something related to it. But giant reptiles in general, there's evidence for huge crocodiles, huge snakes, things like that. They fascinate me. So from legend, it's the dragon. From biology, it's got to be the thylacine, the Tasmanian wolf, because it's such it's a great example of convergent evolution.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I think it's a great symbol for survival and for hope. And it's the emblem of the CFZ. It's our totem animal. And it's more than any other, it's the one I think is still out there. And it will be such a triumph for conservation if you could find this creature.
Yeah, there are lots of sightings in other parts of Australia too. An area where my mum lives in Queensland. So hopefully you can get back there and keep searching.
And up in New Guinea as well, where they call it Dobsenga. They say, the hill tribes say, there's this creature that looks like a dog, that has stripes, it comes down from the mountains and kills livestock. We don't hunt it because it's taboo, and we call it Dobsenga. Showed a picture of a thylacine, Dobsenga. And we know it used to live there from fossils. And New Guinea is so poorly explored.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
On the same island, you've got stories of 30-foot crocodiles, giant man-eating lizards. Now, that's my sort of holiday destination.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. You just heard an interview with Richard Friedman of the Center for Fortean Zoology. Your hosts were Blake Smith and Dr. Karen Stolzno. Links to Richard's website and books are available in the show notes at monstertalk.org. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of my guests and myself. And besides, you know what they say about opinions, right? Everybody's got them, and they're not necessarily the opinions of the Skeptic Society or Skeptic Magazine. What a weird saying. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Keep listening. We've got a fun episode on mummies coming up soon, which I just can't keep under wraps much longer. If you like Monster Talk, why not take a couple of minutes and give us a review on iTunes? It's free. I get to see what you think of the show, and it helps others decide whether or not to give us a try. And if you hate Monster Talk, why not give us a heartfelt review on your favorite Commodore 64 bulletin board system? I want to remind you about our Monster Talk cruise. Details are at cruise.monstertalk.org, and I'd really love to get a chance to meet listeners and hang out in the tropical breeze talking monsters and mysteries. I really hope you can make it. Also, I'll be appearing on this week's episode of The Virtual Skeptics live at 8 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday, June 4th. That's a web video show hosted by several of my skeptical colleagues, and it's free to watch at virtualskeptics.org. I hope you can join us for that, too. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks for listening.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.
We don't really edit for content per se, but I do try to cut down on the uhs and the ums that I'm inevitably going to drop. And the example there, right?
Nice.